Welcome to CII Podcasts.
I want to give a bit more background about myself so that you understand why I am so passionate about this topic of innovation. I grew up in a relatively poor family in India. And the only reason this fact is relevant for today's conversation is in my formative years, what I saw was lots and lots of problems. And our family had very few resources. If you have lots and lots of problems and you have very few resources, the only way you can solve your problem is through innovation. There is no other way. We can't throw money at the problem. We didn't have money. That is why I became so passionate about this topic of innovation. Then, through some process of luck, I got admission to Harvard Business School, where I did my MBA and doctorate, and subsequently was on the faculty at Harvard Business School, and now I am on Tuck School faculty. In the last 50 years, I have dedicated my life to understand everything I possibly can about this concept of innovation. And I have developed this framework, three-box solution, as a way to articulate the point of view about innovation. I want you to think about everything you do inside your organization and put them in three boxes. How many of your activities are in box one? And box one is about manage the present. It is about improve the performance of your organization the way it is constructed today. It is about optimizing your system as it exists today. If you want an example, think about General Motors. Their box one challenge today is how do you improve the performance of internal combustion driven gasoline powered automobiles, from which they are deriving probably 99% of their revenues and 100% of their profits. Think about how many activities you have in your organization which are in box two. And box two is about selectively forget the past. And how many of your activities that you pursue are in box three? And box three is about create the future. Manage the present, box one. Selectively abandon the past, box two. And create the future, box three. And what I find working with organizations is organizations way over focus on box one. And then they think they are doing strategy. Is box one important? Absolutely. Is box one critical? Absolutely. But strategy must include box two and box three. And what is the challenge for organizations in box three? The challenge is, how do you create your future in the year 2030? And if you want to create your future in the year 2030, then you have a job to do in box two. Namely, you have to selectively forget. And let me clarify one thing right away. Strategy for any organization, therefore it includes all the organizations that are represented in this Zoom meeting, is about becoming a leader in the year 2030. But strategy is not about what you have to do in the year 2030. It is very much about the projects you are doing in the year 2024 across the three boxes so that you intersect with the year 2030. How are you allocating your resources today? How is the organization's energy focused today across the three boxes, so that you become relevant in the next decade? For General Motors, if it wants to be relevant in the year 2030. It is not about what General Motors has to do in the year 2030. It's about what General Motors has to do in the year 2024 across the three boxes. And you would agree with me, by year 2030, auto mobility space would be completely different than what it looks today. Self-driving cars will become a reality. Ride sharing will become a reality. Electric vehicles will become a reality. Therefore, the challenge for General Motors is, in box one, they have to improve the efficiency of internal combustion-driven gasoline-powered automobiles. But in the year 2024, they have another job, which is to invest and build capabilities to create electric vehicles, to create self-driving cars, to create other models of mobility. Another word for box one is competition for the present. That is all about efficiency. Another word for box two, box three is competition for the future. That is all about innovation. Of course, competition for the present is important. It is as important as competition for the future is. Therefore, strategy for any organization is always about how do you create the future while managing the present. And the reason why this is a challenge is the thinking process, the people, the capabilities, the processes that are required to excel in box one are fundamentally different. Then the people, the processes, the capabilities that are required in box two, box three. Yet in the year 2024, you have to do both. This is the central strategic challenge. Let me give you a very simple example to highlight why this is such a humongous challenge. Imagine the year is 1903. Imagine you are in Boston and you want to go to London. In the year 1903, there is only one way you can make the trip. That would be by a ship. And a ship those days took 45 days to make the trip. Suppose you wanted to go faster than 45 days, what could you do? One thing I can do is to call a meeting of the Shipbuilders Association, study the ship, increase the engine speed, study the weather conditions on the ocean. This is what I call box one thinking. This is about taking a known system and trying to improve its performance. By the way, 100 years of doing that, even today, the fastest ship will probably take 5 days to do a cross-Atlantic trip. In the year 1903, Wright Brothers focused on box two, box three. Wright Brothers focused on competition for the future. They asked a fundamentally different question. They asked the question, can we avoid ground altogether when we travel? Today, a plane probably will take 5 hours to do a cross-Atlantic trip, whereas even the fastest ship will take 5 days. Not that improving the performance of the ship is unimportant, but if you want to create the future, if India, for instance, in the healthcare sector, wants to become a leader in the year 2030, it is not enough for Indian healthcare sector just to improve the performance of the lot of the ships we have. We must invent the plane in the year 2024 so that we can become a leader in the year 2030. And you would agree with me, the people, the processes, the capabilities it takes to improve the efficiency of the ship is fundamentally different. Then the people, the processes, the capabilities, the mindset that is required to invent the plane. This is the central challenge for India today. I put the economic history of India into three phases. Pre pre-1993. This is before we opened the Indian economy for global competition. That was the license Raj, where we essentially had very, very mediocre growth. The second phase is the last 20, 25 years, where India has grown. But India has grown by essentially becoming more efficient, because we put so much fat before 1990. If you just reduce the fat, you can show growth, with a few exceptions like Narayana Health and the IT sector. By and large, India's growth in the last 20, 25 years is based on closing our efficiency gap, performance gap, which is all a box one stuff. I think if India has to become a leader in the year 2030, our ambition is to go from, we are now number five in the world, behind US, China, Germany, and Japan. We want to be number three in the world by 2030, behind US and China. Then we have to close our innovation gap, our box two, box three gap. And that requires very fundamental different set of capabilities, processes, mental models, etc. I'll give you one example of an exciting box three project that I recently saw. And then I want to invite my friend, my mentor, Dr. Devi Shetty, to share his story about Narayana Health. The recent example that I saw, her name is Seema Prem, and the fintech startup she has created is called FIA Global, which received, by the way, she received the Innovator of the Year award this year, well deserved. Her story is so interesting. Seema Prem got her electrical engineering degree in India, obviously a very smart person. Then she got her MBA at MIT Sloan. She worked in between in the financial sector. Then she went to get her MBA at MIT Sloan. In MIT Sloan, they encouraged their students to start entrepreneurship ventures. In fact, they have a competition where you submit proposals. And she submitted an entrepreneurship proposal. She won the second prize. And she used that proposal to start this fintech in India. What is the problem she is trying to solve? And this fintech startup is about a decade old. So if you think back in year 2010, India by then has completed Aadhaar. So we have been able to establish unique identity for 1.4 billion people. And the reason we started Aadhaar was government wanted to give welfare payments directly to people. And if you want to do that, you have to know the unique identity of people. Otherwise, there is corruption. Because if you hand over $10 million to a politician and say, distribute it to the poor, politician could put it in his or her pocket. That is why India started this unique identity, which is a box three idea by itself. By year 2010, they faced another challenge, which is in India, in year 2010, there were 400 million Indians who did not have bank accounts. And they said, if I wanted to directly pay welfare payments to the poor, unique identity is wonderful, but if they have a bank account, I can put it directly into the bank account. Therefore, Indian government at that time pressured the Indian banks like State Bank of India to convert these 400 million Indians who don't have bank accounts, convert them into banking customers. Now, think about for a second, why in year 2010, 400 million Indians didn't have bank accounts? Bulk of them, most of them live in rural India. Imagine a village with 100 people. State Bank of India does not want to open a branch there, which is their traditional business model. because for 100 people, it's not scale efficient. Therefore, what State Bank did was to open a branch in a small town, which catered to 200 villages. So that gives you catchment area. But what is the problem here? The problem is, now the villager has to travel half a day to the town to open an account. Maybe he'll spend more money on bus than what he'll be able to deposit. Not only that, the villagers are daily wage earners. They don't want to give up their job for half a day to travel to open an account. Opportunity cost is too high. But there was also another issue, which is villagers love to trust people when they give money. And they don't know anybody in the town. So they don't want to hand over their $100 to someone they have not even met. So this is the problem. The traditional banking model has not been able to convert these 400 million non-customers of bank into customers of bank. This is what Seema Prem decided to tackle. This is the entrepreneurship proposal that she submitted in MIT Sloan, which is an amazing proposal. So she went back to India in the last 10 years. This is what she has done. Now, how has she solved this problem? So she goes to that 100-person village and first selects a person who is most trustworthy in that 100-person village and calls that person a business correspondent. Now, that person could be someone who is, say, owning a mom-and-pop store in that village. Every villager knows that person. Maybe that person's father was running that shop, grandfather was running the shop. That means this guy is not going to run away from that village with your money. Then she went to State Bank. That was her first customer. She went to State Bank and said, I will help you open a branch in this 100-person village. What I want from you is give me a personal computer and give me a biometric device. So she takes those two and gives to this business correspondent. So when a villager comes and says, I want to open an account with $100, the first thing the business correspondent does is to do an eye scan. Because India has already, in Aadhaar, has 1.4 billion eye scans are digitally stored in New Delhi. So when he takes an eye scan of this villager, it is a unique identity. So it is connects with the digitally stored eye scans in New Delhi and says, yes, this guy is legitimate. This is Vijay Govindaraj. He is legitimate. Then the villager gives the business correspondent $100 to open an account. Because unified payment interface, the digital payment system, is also completed in India, immediately the business correspondent can take $100 physical cash and open an account in Vijay Govindarajan's name in State Bank of India in Mumbai and digitally transfer the $100 to my account. Then soon the villager said, I would like to get a loan. Now, giving loans to villagers is a very high-risk proposition. So what the Seema Prem has done, she has built a very sophisticated AI model. She lives in Gurgaon. So there, she looks at the transaction history of that villager. Suppose the villager has a bank balance of $1,000 and the villager wants a loan for $1,200. Because she has transaction history, she can begin to see whether the villager was growing the balance from zero to $1,000, how fast. Will the villager be able to get and repay the $1,200 soon? Therefore, she is able to intelligently manage risk. By the way, the loan loss for Seema Prem, when she gives loans to these villagers, is 0.0001%. When State Bank of India gives loans in urban India, their loss ratio is 3%. So she's able to actually manage down a risk in a high risk category. Soon, she convinced the villagers, hey, you got a bank balance of $1,000. Why don't you also participate in a mutual fund so that you can get better returns? So she created an investment product. She created a micro insurance. She is providing one-stop shop for financial inclusion. By the way, she started this company about a decade ago. She has converted 90 million Indians into banking customers. And I want you to think about that number. 90 million is the size of Vietnam. She has transformed the size of Vietnam. And she is not charity. This is not a non-profit. This is a fintech, just like Citibank's or any other fintech. This is a for-profit venture. So she is making money and transforming the lives of 90 million people, 90 million communities. This is the power of Box 3 innovation, the value you can create, the wealth you can create, the job you can create, and how you can grow the Indian economy. I can't think of a better example of Box 3 than what Dr. Devi Shetty has done in Narayana Health. Just think about open heart surgery as an example. In Narayana Health, open heart surgery costs $2,000. In the US, open heart surgery costs $150,000. And I want you to think about these two numbers. In the US, open heart surgery costs $150,000. In Narayana Health, it costs $2,000. Because in Narayana Health, open heart surgery costs 75 times less, that does not mean their quality is 75 times inferior. I don't even know how you can do poor quality heart surgery. One measure of quality in heart surgery is mortality rates 30 days after surgery. For Narayana Health, their mortality rate 30 days after surgery is 1.2%. The US average is 2%. So the quality is on par, maybe even better. How do you create an ultra-low-cost healthcare which is accessible to the masses and at the same time provide world-class quality? This is exactly what Seema Prem did for financial inclusion. This is the opportunity in India. The opportunity in India is to go after markets which are not served. That means there is zero competition in those markets. But there is a reason why there is zero competition. You need to understand what are the constraints, why poor people don't have access to financial services, why poor people don't have access to education, why poor people don't have access to healthcare. Understand the constraints. And then through Box 3 innovation, blow open those constraints. You can make money, and you can have tremendous social impact. At this stage, I would like to invite my friend and mentor, Dr. Devi Shetty, to share his reflections on his own journey in Narayana Health in terms of 3-Box Solution.
Thank you. I'm extremely grateful to you, sir, for your guidance and to a large extent mentorship. I'll quickly talk about the future. I believe that India will become the first country in the world to dissociate healthcare from wealth. India will prove to the world that the wealth of the nation or wealth of the family has nothing to do with the quality of healthcare its citizens will enjoy. Now, you all must be thinking that, yes, it is going to happen, but it's going to take maybe 30 years or 50 years. No, India is going to do it within the next 5 to 7 years. this transformation will happen with the understanding that universal healthcare with the taxpayers' money is an illusion, whereas universal health insurance is a reality which can be done, which can be accomplished. I will explain why this transition should happen. We have studied all the countries, some countries which have successfully managed universal healthcare for free with the taxpayers' money. All these countries have three things in common. All these countries are invariably small countries with a population of 1 million, 10 million, 15, 20 million. No single country in the world with a large population, including United States of America, can offer free healthcare to the citizens with the taxpayers' money. Simply not done. The second common trait with these countries is that they have a very high tax to GDP ratio, over 20%, 40%, 45%. A country like India, we have a tax to GDP ratio of 11.5%. So it is, government doesn't control that much of wealth. So this is the second fact. Third fact is, all these countries which are offering universal healthcare are already spending between 10% to 20% of the GDP on healthcare. We are only spending about 1.2, 1.5%. So our option is to switch from current expectation to universal health insurance. Now, why this hasn't happened? This hasn't happened mainly because of the trust deficit. We have health insurance companies. In healthcare, there are three stakeholders. There is health insurance company, there is hospital, and there is patient. Hospitals do not trust the health insurance company. Health insurance company doesn't trust the hospitals. And the patient doesn't trust both parties, and those two parties don't trust the patients. So essentially, we have three stakeholders in this entire game, and they don't trust each other. So when three important stakeholders in any business do not trust each other, that business cannot be scaled up. Now, look at the point of view of the hospitals. Today, when I tell a patient that you need bypass grafting, first thing what goes to patient mind is it really required? Or I'm asked to get the surgery done so they can make some money out of me. Because there is a conflict of interest. Now, reverse the situation. My hospital group becomes a health insurance company. Then, when I tell a patient you need a bypass grafting, he will gladly agree because I'm going to pay for it. Then the conflict of interest problem is addressed. Now, why this is important for a hospital like ours to become an insurance company is because about 15 to 18% of the heart surgery done in India is done by our group. More people develop heart attack, it is better for my business. We have absolutely no incentive to prevent people from developing the heart attack. But that will change the moment we become a health insurance company. So this is the motivation for us to consider becoming a health insurance company. And I'm very happy to inform you that today we have become a health insurance company. The first hospital group to become a health insurance company, and the health insurance is owned by the hospital. So we hope that we will be able to come up with product for everyone, especially the working class and the poor people. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
That is a phenomenal observation and insight, Dr. Shetty. Is this the model of Kaiser Permanente group in California?
Yes. Managed care, yes.
Yeah. And I think we need to align the incentives so that the hospital, which are the providers, have incentive to focus on prevention as opposed to treatment, and really keep the healthcare costs down and still provide world class. I think it makes a ton of sense. Let me ask you another question. How do you think AI and generative AI is going to transform healthcare, not just in India, but all over the world?
It will have a very big impact, but it will only remain as a tool. First thing is, we believe that in the near future, smart software will make smarter diagnosis than the doctors. And within the next few years, it will become legally mandatory for the doctors across the world to get the second opinion from the software, powered by AI, of course, to get the second opinion. And if the doctor, it is not the doctor has to follow the AI's diagnosis. Doctor has to justify his diagnosis compared to the AI diagnosis. That will dramatically change the way we approach the problem. There is a radiologist who made a statement, I think from Germany. He said, AI will not replace the radiologist, but a radiologist who uses the AI will replace the radiologist who doesn't use the AI. So essentially, this is a very, very powerful tool. What AI will do is to prevent us from making mistakes. Medical error is the third leading cause of death in US. Medical error happens because today the healthcare comprises of multiple data coming all the time. And you think about a situation wherein a patient in the ICU at 3 o'clock in the morning, critically unwell, whichever doctor is on duty, do you honestly expect him to use his all the sixth sense to putting all the data coming from multiple equipments and the labs and everything and coming up with the right diagnosis? Whereas a software which is powered by AI will solve this problem. But there is a fundamental problem. The fundamental problem is 80% of the hospitals across the world do not have electronic medical record or a digital platform. So if they do not have an electronic medical record, the AI cannot work. So essentially, all these smart tools what we have developed in AI and all these areas, they're like very fancy vehicles with all kinds of fancy functions. But nobody has built the road for this vehicle to move. So it is very, very important that the digital platform adoption should happen. And I again strongly believe that this digital platform innovation of providing a very, very smart, advanced digital platform powered by AI will happen in India.
Very interesting point, Devi, because I have been thinking a lot about something very similar, which is in India, I find the IT sector and the Indian manufacturing sector, which is physical asset oriented, have been going in parallel, in silos, without any interaction. And I think the time has come for the Indian digital talent to actually transform the Indian manufacturing talent, manufacturing sector, including healthcare, which is also a heavy physical asset. And the transformation will create new forms of mobility in the auto and two-wheeler sector, new ways of smart homes, thinking about precision agriculture, thinking about personalized health. These require digital technologies and the physical assets to be completely fused so that, as you say, we build the digital platform in every hospital. and so that they can be connected, because connection will create enormous opportunity for us to derive insights, because data and AI should be at the heart of the Indian manufacturing sector. Do you agree with that?
I agree with you 100%. This is the journey we took 20 years ago. We realized that hospitals should have a EMR and a digital platform. So we tied up. We are blessed in having fantastic technology companies. We worked with many of them. But after spending millions of dollars, we were not reaching anywhere. Fundamentally, the way the Indian software companies work, they are not oriented towards building a product. They're extremely smart, they are brilliant people, but the orientation is different. So I think around 7 or 8 years ago, our young team decided that this is not the way forward. We should build our own software team to build our own electronic medical record. And I fought tooth and nail with them, saying that we are not a software company and we don't have the knowledge to build it. And the answer from our young team was that if those Indian multi-billion dollar companies can hire people to do the work, they are after all hiring Indians, we also can hire Indians. And believe me, today we have nearly 300 software engineers who have built an amazing platform. And I simply cannot imagine their brilliance. You can go to them with any complex problem. Within 24 hours, they come up with a wireframe, and within 1 or 2 weeks, you have a product. And they keep on upgrading the EMR what we have virtually every few weeks. And today we have the most, I can confidently say that nowhere in the world you have integration of the doctor, nurse, technicians, machines, and the patient family on the same platform, which gets connected to all the stakeholders seamlessly 24 hours. And the experience is great. Today, when patients come to our hospital, as soon as their blood test gets done, automatically they can see the report in their mobile phone. So our hospitals today have no reception. Patients register themselves on their mobile phone, or if they don't have a smartphone, there are kiosks. You go to the ICU, there may not be many intensivists, because intensivists can run the ICU from home. So essentially, you are looking at a different type of a hospital, which is emerging in India. And this will be truly a game changer.
Amazing insights, Devi. And let me share with you some of my thoughts here. You know, I joined the Harvard Business School faculty in 1980. And at that time, they started what they thought was a revolutionary research topic, which is, they wanted the faculty to answer the question, how would information technology, we used to call it information technology those days, how would information technology change the world of business and the discipline of management? So that's the question they wanted the faculty to research. We are asking the same question in the year 2024. How would digital technologies affect the world of business and the discipline of management? But the context is very different today as compared to 1980. Because in 1980, the best piece of hardware we had in 1980 was something called IBM PC with a green screen. That is probably in some museum now. The best piece of software we had at that time was Lotus 1-2-3. We didn't know anything about internet. We didn't know anything about mobile. We didn't know anything about Gen AI. Today, we have a lot more digital tools than what we had. So that means the transformation potential for business is that much better today. But here is the point that I want to drive home, Devi, which is, if you think about it, of course, information technology transformed business in the 80s, 90s, etc. but it did not affect individuals. By that I mean, in the 80s, we had ERP, SAP, all that stuff, but it didn't affect individuals because the way we lived, the way we listened to music, the way we played, the way we transacted was all in the analog world because we still met in person and paid Indian rupees in cash. In the year 2023, individuals are affected by digital technologies. All that you have to do is to go to a subway train. Everybody is looking at an iPhone. The way we live, the way we play, the way we transact in the year 2024, individuals is in the digital space. Even a country like India, nobody wants cash. Even a beggar wants a QR code. So we have become digital because of this one device called iPhone. What happened was, we gave permission in the iPhone for them to track data from us. Therefore, as a customer, you quickly check the box which said, I agree, so that you can go to the app. So companies like Google and Facebook and so on and so forth collected data. Here is the point that I want to make, Davey, which is I compared the top 10 market capitalized companies in the world in January 2007. And the reason I chose January 2007 was iPhone was not introduced. Of the top 10 companies, there was only one tech company, Microsoft. Everybody else was physical asset company, which would be manufacturing companies like Toyota, General Electric, or ExxonMobil, etc. Today, you take a look at the top 10 market capitalized companies in the world, all the 10 are tech companies, not a single physical asset company. By the way, the tech companies that you see today on the list are different than the IT companies of the 80s and 90s. This is not IBM. This is not Cisco. This is not Infosys. This is different type of digital players. This is Google and Facebook and so on, so Amazon, Apple. The reason I'm pointing this out is in the last 17 years, 2007 to 2024, these digital companies have essentially digitized the consumer sector. The way we listen to music, the way we make payments, the way we watch movies, they have digitized that. And think about the wealth and value they've created in these 17 years. These companies are worth trillions of dollars. By the way, the world's GDP today is $100 trillion. Out of that $100 trillion of GDP in the world, only 25% is in the consumer sector. That means we have so far digitized $25 trillion. Because this iPhone, you can use to digitize that. That has created this kind of wealth. Imagine the potential if we can digitize the industrial sectors, like healthcare, like automobiles, like mining, like construction. That is $75 trillion. Because you can't digitize a tractor just with iPhone. You need IoT, you need sensors, etc. That's why it doesn't happen so far. This is the opportunity, David. This is the opportunity. Therefore, I want to see Narayana Health not as a healthcare company, but as a data and AI company. Which happens to be in healthcare. By the way, about 10 years ago, I had the privilege of meeting Elon Musk, and he told me something which stuck in my mind. He said, VG, I am creating a data and AI company which will make automobiles. That is a fundamentally different framing. By the way, today he is a significant player in auto insurance because he is able to use data and AI to create, enter new spaces. That is how Indian manufacturing should think. If you are TVS Motor, you got to say, I'm not making two-wheelers. I'm a data and AI company which happened to make two-wheelers. If you're Mahindra Mahindra, I'm a data and AI company which happened to make tractors. Because that framing suddenly opens up all kinds of ways by which we can solve customer problems. And I think you are on that journey faster than others.
Thanks.
I love your example of the software team that you put together.
Thanks.
And created this data and AI capability. That is a true Box 3 game changer. I would love to sit down with you and understand more about what you have done and write a case study on it, because this is a big, this is a huge Box 3.
Thanks. Vijay, we describe ourselves, Narayana Health is a software company with a few beds attached to it.
Yeah, I love it.
And you talked about the mobile phone. The $1 billion of valued EMRs of US. In US, the electronic medical records cost $1 billion. Literally $1 billion. Now, they are built for the desktop and the laptop. But if you look at the way doctors work, doctors look at the laptop or the desktop 5 to 6 times in a day. But they look at the mobile phone 200 times in a day. So from very beginning, we took the approach of mobile first. Yeah. All our digital electronic medical records are built for the mobile phone. Of course, you can use it on a laptop. But today, 5 years ago, I never thought as a doctor, I will take a clinical decision on patient care based on the chest x-ray or an image I see in the mobile phone. Today, everyone takes clinical decisions because our entire ICU runs on the mobile phone, digital, our software on a mobile phone. And the changes brought about is phenomenal. I'll just give you one example. We predict that within the next 1 year, when our large-scale adoption of the ECG strips for getting the patient's data, once it is across the hospital, we will be able to eliminate sudden cardiac arrest happening in the ward. We'll be able to eliminate, not reduce. How it will happen is, I'll give you an example. Today, a nurse starts in the ward. I'm not talking about the ICU. They start the rounds in the morning. They take a BP apparatus and the thermometer, go to first bed, check the pulse rate, temperature, blood pressure, respiratory rate, and they enter it. That takes about minimum of 10-15 minutes. Then they go to the next bed and the next bed. By the time they finish 30 beds, it's a time for her to do it all over again. It's a very boring, mundane job. But the worst thing is, 2 o'clock at night, when a nurse goes to check the blood pressure of a patient, first reaction from the patient is patient screams at her because he can't go back to sleep again. So to avoid that problem, a lot of the time, nurses don't record, but they don't check, but they record something. Essentially, if they don't record, they will be screamed at by the bosses the next day. And they don't want to be screamed. So in the process, the system is created that we encourage a professionally conscientious people to lie. That is the system. So in the process, maximum number of cardiac arrests happen in the ward at around 4 o'clock and 6 o'clock in the morning, because at night patient is not monitored. So now we have got a startup in Bangalore. They developed a ECG strip, which gives a continuous ECG recording with the analytics, temperature, pulse rate, restlessness, blood pressure, everything goes online. And nurses are told that you don't need to touch the patient, you stay in your nursing counter. There is a TV in the nursing counter with all the patient's name, and there are 3 color flags, green, orange, and red. when the risk score increases by some whatever changes happen in the patient body, then only nurses will go and see the patient. When this happens, because before the cardiac arrest happens, 6 hours to 12 hours before the cardiac arrest happens, pulse rate start going up, patient gets restless, oxygen saturation comes down, and the machines can monitor it without getting tired, these sensors. And they give the risk score, we can actually eliminate the cardiac. Cardiac arrest may still happen, but it will happen in a controlled environment in the ICU, not in the ward. So today we are not talking about reducing the mortality, we are talking about eliminating mortality.
Amazing, because I, in my experience, one of the frustrating things that I find in companies is databases are in silos. They are not connected at all.
Exactly.
The marketing has its own database, manufacturing, and that is so suboptimal. You want the data and AI to be led by the CEO. This is not to be delegated to data scientists. This is transforming the company. Therefore, it should be CEO led. It should be everybody's job, and it should be business owned. This is not, because in the past we have always said, if it's in an ERP or SAP system, the IT companies will handle it. I don't have to worry about it. No. If you want to be a data and AI company, then the business people have to own it. They have to understand it. And I think it's a lot of what you're saying makes a lot of sense to me. Before I turn it over to CII, I would say, Dr. Shetty, I think India has a very big opportunity here. You said India can lead in healthcare. Show how we can create a digital health company, just like the way Amazon is a digital retailer. We can create a $1 trillion digital health company. I say we can actually create a digital tractor company, a digital automobile company, because in some sense, manufacturing, the U.S. has given up its manufacturing to low-cost countries. So we don't have manufacturing. We hollowed out, send it to Mexico, China, etc. I think to have a strong economy, you need a strong manufacturing base. But the manufacturing shouldn't be done in the 20th century style, which is gasoline-powered, internal combustion-driven automobile, if you're General Motors. We need smart machines. We need intelligent machines. We need machines and digital completely connected together. And India not only has low cost, but very high caliber digital talent. We have mechanical engineers. And under Modi's government, we have invested in digital infrastructure, we're investing in physical infrastructure, which is needed for manufacturing, supply chain issues. Therefore, India has a very rare opportunity now, particularly given the US-China relationship. People want, multinationals want manufacturing to be in another country, and India has the scale. But we need to think about new ways of manufacturing. A smart industrial. I think India has a very rare opportunity in the next decade to become a global leader in maybe electric vehicles, maybe in tractors, maybe in healthcare. We pick 10 sectors where we can win and put the, if you're government, bring the policymakers, bring the startup entrepreneurs, bring the big industrial houses like Tata's and Birla's and Mahindra's, and say, we are going to choose 10 sectors where India is going to show the world how we can do new ways of manufacturing, which the world needs.
I agree with you, Vijay. That has to happen. That will happen.
Someone of your caliber and influence, I hope you will take that to Prime Minister. I would be happy to play whatever role I can. But this is the India's moment, really. We got to grab it. This is almost like in the mid-90s when we had a moment and we grabbed and created the IT services, which opened up enormous wealth, enormous opportunities. Now we are at the similar moment where we can create data and AI companies and smart industrial companies. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to CII Podcasts.